Lately, I've been watching The Partridge Family with my 9-year-old daughter. For our younger listeners, let me explain that The Partridge Family was a groovy sitcom from the early 1970s. In each episode, a super relatable white bread family, led by mega cute single mom Shirley Jones, breezes through a domestic issue, a social issue, an issue specific to a family that has a hit record and whose drummer is 7 years old, and then finishes with an awkward lip sync to a pop song that falls somewhere between a ballad by the Archies and a Mormon Fifth Dimension. It's basically the greatest American sitcom, and it should be taught in schools. One of its great pleasures is the revolving door of guest stars like Dick Clark, Johnny Cash, and Howard Cosell, often playing bit parts and a veritable who's who of young actors in their first roles. Mark Hamill as a teenage boyfriend, Farrah Fawcett as a girl in a mini dress outside a bank. Jodie Foster is there, Cheryl Ladd and Rob Reiner. Every episode is an Easter egg hunt, and occasionally one of the songs is even kind of good. Also, the costumes alone should have been given a Presidential Medal of Freedom. So imagine my surprise and delight when on the episode we watched earlier tonight, the guest stars were Richard Pryor and a young Louis Gossett Jr. It was... wow. See, there was a mix-up. The Partridge Family showed up to their Detroit gig thinking it was supposed to be in a posh hotel lobby, only to find out that it was in a derelict inner-city fire station. Richard Pryor and Louis Gossett Jr. explained that they were expecting The Temptations. Seems that the booking agent intentionally switched the bands as part of a nefarious real estate plot, and presumably, The Temptations were just then arriving at a posh hotel in Tucson for a show they imagined was booked in a derelict fire station. The actors gamely plow their way through a script where Shirley Jones suggests a block party to Richard Pryor, adorable 10-year-old Danny recruits a bunch of barely toned down for TV black nationalists to play violins, and David Cassidy collaborates with Pryor on an Afro sound number that gets the people dancing and saves the day. It's hilariously improbable, excruciating to watch, and exquisite. We talk a lot about race on Friendly Fire because war movies quite frequently make race a central issue, because race and racism are often prime motivators of war. We joke that the 90s were a time when America desperately wanted to be a post-racial society, and Hollywood kept putting Denzel in the unenviable position of being the first black detective or spy or submarine officer or whatever whose race never came into it once. And we have to rue that fantasy also. We watch all our movies with a modicum of the wisdom of retrospect. We have a soupçon of the present moment and, I hope, always an eye on a better future. Well, we watched Carter's Army several months ago. The quarantine has allowed us the luxury of building up a nice catalog of advanced recordings. So this episode was made well before Da Five Bloods came out and months before the killing of George Floyd and the resurgence of Black Lives Matter. If we recorded the show today, we would, of course, be contextualizing many of the movie's themes in these recent terms. Yet despite this lag, the relevance of Carter's Army didn't escape us then. The specific gravity of the culture has changed radically in the last 6 months, but the motivating forces have not. Black lives mattered 6 months ago, too. Richard Pryor appeared on The Partridge Family after he made Carter's Army. And although the Partridge Family episode, which, did I mention, was titled Soul Club? Well, it was the more spectacular failure of the two, but both programs were trying hard to redress an imbalance, to make a statement, to turn the conversation, to increase understanding, and to heal wounds. They both date from primetime television 50 years ago. I wish to God that righteousness could save our lives, but today on Friendly Fire, Carter's Army.
Absolutely.
Nothing.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Welcome to Friendly Fire, the war movie podcast that wants to know who we'd be saluting if we saluted. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Branica.
And I'm John Roderick.
I feel like 1970 is one of the more touch-pointy years on our list. We've got like Tora 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 is in 1970. Like a lot of strange stuff pops up in 1970. MASH. This is a TV movie.
Now this is crazy. Did we ever watch a TV movie before this?
I don't think so. No. This one was really the perfect format for you to watch on your watch in the bathtub.
For someone who wants to take many breaks.
This is like somebody illegally copied the DVD release of the TV movie and then uploaded it somehow to Amazon Prime. Because there's like, it feels like stuff is missing, right? Like instead of fading out, it like hard cuts.
Like back in the days when people used to record TV movies on VHS tapes and then have entire bookcases full of stuff that they taped off of the TV. This seems like that for sure.
But like this, in between scenes, like the music cuts hard in a way that makes me think that they trimmed out, I don't know, establishing shots or just crossfades to the like movie of the week logo. That's
what I think it actually is the transitions were crossfades into commercials or logos, and we just cut before we even see that.
Yeah. Those musical cuts are so abrupt that I started to laugh every time, and then it became like a leitmotif. I was just waiting for the next time that this big swelling orchestral score would just like clam, and it became one of the things I found most delightful about the film.
You gotta be kidding!
I thought those aspects might have crippled the film, but I really didn't think they did at all.
No, the film was perfectly capable of crippling itself.
Oh, go on.
I mean, it is such a weird movie. It's like the conflict that the movie is centered around is a great pitch, right? Racist officer is put in command of a troop of black soldiers and has to learn how to command them. Like, sold in the room, but then he's not as stridently racist as all that. Like, he's given a couple of scenes where he like calls a black guy boy or whatever, but he never like espouses a worldview that is like really racially hierarchical or anything.
Oh, he says that one line where he's like, you know, oh, black boys are doing what they're best at, which is loading trucks and digging latrines, and the army just gave him a job.
Yeah, but he's made to look bad for saying that, and he like feels bad about saying it in the moment because they're also like confronting him with the idea that like they wish they had had basic training, but they didn't get it. And he's like, well, that is bad. Like, you know,
right.
I feel like if he'd been like a more hateable guy at the beginning and gone on a bigger journey, there's like something here.
Yeah, he seems like a Southern officer who's just living in the world that he lives in and is confronted by this situation, which he kind of just makes natural assumptions about.
Yeah.
I wonder to what extent it would be an impossibility to show Carter's story in that kind of way. Like, 1970 is a really interesting year because, like, what depictions of black people did we get on TV? This was years before Good Times or The Jeffersons or Sanford and Son were on TV. And
not that many years before.
Yeah, but Roots wasn't on TV until 77 either. Like, and even blaxploitation films didn't begin to get produced until a few years after this. So I wonder if they just didn't think to do it this way because there was no template for it. Like, I'm not forgiving the many problems this film has, but like, I don't think you can expect an ABC movie of the week to solve for these representation problems.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that's really where my criticism is necessarily, but like, it's a strange thing to watch this movie and puzzle through in your mind, like, what was the audience thinking seeing this? Like, did it seem super didactic? Did it seem like a movie that was like scolding a racist American public for their crimes of the past, or did people like, was it super widespread knowledge that the army was segregated in World War II? Cause like, it almost seemed like, it seems like that came as a surprise to Carter when he shows up. Like,
John, you were 30 when this movie came out. What did you think?
I was 30 during World War II. It was widespread knowledge that the army was segregated in World War II. I think you could almost have said that that was universally known and acknowledged.
Because I think that the culture has kind of forgotten that now. Like, I don't think if you like grabbed a high school kid and said, hey, like, what was the deal with segregation in the army in 1943? If you would get a cohesive answer.
And it's too bad because segregation in World War II in particular played a huge role in the civil rights movement of the 50s, because black soldiers in the American army who went to Europe and were fighting Nazi racism were doing so from within a Jim Crow army. And so you read a lot of the writing of, you know, those early civil rights leaders, and they're describing the experience of being in occupied Germany after the war and feeling free of racism because the Germans saw them primarily as Americans. And so they were accorded all this respect as members of the American occupying army, that when they went then back to their own, you know, American, well, when they rotated back to America, they were living in a Jim Crow America. But in the army during the war, you know, we haven't really watched a movie yet about the Tuskegee Airmen or the, you know, the Buffalo Brigades, but it was a real, you know, there were like a million black Americans fighting in World War II. Yeah. And it was a very conscious and on the surface struggle where, you know, the same way that Muhammad Ali, when they asked him why he didn't fight in Vietnam, in one sentence made the appeal, like,
my conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America.
This was like a spoken and widely understood problem. Like, the Red Cross had separate blood banks for black and white soldiers. They wouldn't give you a blood transfusion with blood from a different race. You know, it was appalling. And so it is in some ways like they came back to the United States and they were like, look, we fought a war against the racist Germans from within a racist army. So yeah, I think anybody that was in the war understood it. There just wasn't any. I read somewhere where they went looking, some documentarians went looking for footage of black soldiers in World War II because they were going to do a documentary, and they could hardly find any.
Yeah.
Even though there were a million guys serving, they, you know, in all of the footage, they just couldn't find any. And a lot of it was because they were peeling potatoes, but also it was because there wasn't. Even the ones that were in combat, you know, the newsreels just erased them.
You know, when I shot a lot of corporate video, you know, you go into these big workplaces and you get your B-roll, you're often told, like, don't shoot the guys with logos on their shirts or any number of other rules about capturing footage of this kind. It makes me wonder to what extent, you know, people were just told not to shoot them.
Oh, 100%. 100% that's what was happening. I mean, I think, yeah, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing within the United States. Like, in 1943, it was a year where there were race riots throughout the United States. So much so that the vice president went to Detroit and gave a speech that said, how are we going to defeat the Nazis if we're having race riots here? And he made a direct connection in the speech between white supremacy in the United States and racist Nazi Germany. And he said, you know, and this is something that Roosevelt didn't do. Wallace made it, you know, like, overtly called it out.
Did you ever wonder what happened to those trenches once you leave, huh?
There's some parts that I really liked in the movie. Like, they do persuade Carter that maybe he shouldn't, you know, think less of these soldiers for being guys who clean latrines because that's what they were sent there to do. And that's all, like, the only job they've been allowed to do, basically. Like, that's some pretty heavy shit. Like, when they start enumerating all the jobs that he doesn't want that they're stuck with.
I know, it really sucked. Can you imagine being in a war where you're watching guys drive by in trucks, you know, loaded for bear, headed up to the front, and you're just peeling potatoes, and you know you're the only reason you're peeling potatoes and aren't allowed to fight is that you're black? It just is like...
Yeah. I mean, that scene at the end is really heavy when the guy throws the shovel out the back of the truck at them. Like,
it reminded me of the Keep America Beautiful Crying Indian ad, like also of the same decade. That was the big takeaway. That's as sophisticated as this film could be at the end of it.
Yeah.
You're right, Adam, that 1970 is a weird time. Blacker liberation movement is in full swing. Vietnam War is in full swing. So, you know, who this movie is, who the audience for it is, it's like the movie of the week aired on Tuesday nights at 8 or something.
Yeah.
It's the essential question, John, who is this film for? Is it for the Carters of the world or the Crunks?
It's not exactly an anti-racist message in the film. Like, Crunk is persuaded, like, Crunk is terrified and not, you know, has not been prepared for this. And the movie doesn't exactly go out of its way to say, like, there's nothing wrong with Crunk for feeling that way because Crunk was never trained for this. It has one of the other characters going, like, what are the white people going to think if they see you cowering in this ditch? Is like that's how he's persuaded to get back into the fight. And, you know, he comports himself with a great deal of heroism by the end, but it's not like his motivation is like put into him by a white writer.
It's like written and directed by white dudes. So there's all this, there's weird messaging, like Rosie Grier, who is the, you know, who's kind of the beloved and seemingly the, you know, who would be the best warrior. Like, they find some wine and get drunk and he gets shot by some farm boy. Like, there are three or four instances where it could be a movie where they were gradually becoming a tighter unit. You know, they were gradually getting into the spirit of being fighters. And then in the end, there's some, you know, they work together to solve a problem. And what this movie does is kind of show us a few sort of examples of how they never got their shit together.
Right. Like, the natural environment of these guys is the dice game that we found them in at the beginning, but right, they did do some stuff okay when they had to.
Can I just say, I love when a movie throws to its own title the way that this film does. Like, I guess it's time for me to introduce you to ... and then we cut to, and then the music strikes, and then we see dice being thrown right at the camera and the title comes up. Like, I love that moment.
And then it cuts back to Carter, like, looking at them like, what the fuck? And then back to them and keeps putting up title cards.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like when the movie becomes self-aware. Like, that's a format to a film of this decade that I just love.
Yeah.
But it did do the thing that we've interrogated before, which is a lot of the character of the black soldiers we only see and learn about through the eyes of the white officer, right? So he says, "Pick up that thing, boy," and the black soldier like demonstrates some humanity, and then walks away, and the white officer is left going, "Huh, seems like he might actually be a American man.
Three-dimensional human being."
What do you know about them apples? But as you said, Adam, like, Richard Pryor's whole, his whole, like, raison d'etre through the second half of the movie, raison d'etre, is just to show Whitey that he's not a coward, rather than generated from inside. He's not on a personal mission at all. And I mean, at the very end, he reveals that he did have some sort of come to Jesus.
Yeah, but what I really like about the Crunk character is that he comes to his decision based on what the Rosie Grier character tells him, which is some form of like history is written by the survivors. Mm-hmm. And so if you're killed down here in a ditch, someone like Carter is going to write your story and it's not going to be good. It's not going to be a good reflection on you. And then 100 years of black soldiers are going to have to try to reverse the stories being told by people like him. And that kind of inspiration, I thought, was pretty powerful, like in a film where there was very little power.
I really disagree with that, because I think that puts the responsibility for it on the Private Crunk character, which the responsibility doesn't lie with him. Like,
yeah, that's right. That's the argument that in order to fight coronavirus, black people need to stop smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, it's the pull up your pants of get in this fight. And I don't know, like I don't trust the movie to be coming from the right place on this when it's a white writer and a white director. And
not just a white writer. We should call him out by name. It's Aaron Spelling. It's Tori Spelling's dad.
Yeah. A TV legend. Like, he's got a zillion credits on IMDb.
It's the reason why the Brandon and Dylan storyline of this film just didn't quite hit home with me.
I really looked for some contemporary black commentary on this movie.
Yeah.
Because I really wanted to know.
It's hard to find, because Black Brigade also refers to like some like Mussolini, right. like right. death squad. So,
but even under Carter's army, like all I could find was criticism of it in recent years. I don't even know how you would find, you know, like a movie review of this from an issue of Ebony in 1970. But, you know, this is that moment, right, where black empowerment is real. There is now a demand for and an audience for like emancipated black male voices in the culture. And yet it still has to get filtered through 3 or 4 different layers. So Marvin Gaye's What's Going On came out a year later, right? So the public is way ahead, I think, of where primetime television is at this point. And there's a lot in this movie that is interrogating. It's just not, it's really inconclusive, right? You don't come out the other side feeling like, I mean, basically you had a suicide mission where instead of 5 guys getting picked off in various like instances, you know, wartime adventures, you get 5 guys picked off by snipers or their own lazy drunkenness or like the fact that they're deaf or, you know, like they're picked off in the weakest ass ways.
Yeah.
There's no heroism in this movie at all until the final scene.
Like, there's such an opportunity to have the stakes of this get like operatic in scope, and the death of the deaf guy as a betrayal of him by, you know, an uncaring army that didn't, you know, that didn't defer his enlistment because of his disability. I think that it's also just kind of facile writing. Like, if the secret code is London Bridge and the uncrackable password is falling down. Like, I don't know if you're going to get to like a we also solved racism in our 1970 movie of the week.
Yeah, it was super clunky. That speech after the deaf guy gets killed and the black lieutenant is like, would you have buried him if he was white? Was like, well, probably not on a mission like this. If we had like 2 hours to get to the dam, like,
yeah,
probably that's not the hill to die on.
I'd love to see the operatic made-for-TV movie in 1970 that gets this right. Like, if there's an example of that as a counterpoint, I'd love to see it.
Well, I don't know if it's a TV movie or whatever, but like, I think the premise and the characters are really interesting, and it's not executed well. Is what I'm getting at, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't feel like that was ever possible. Like, I really want to ask you: do you think it was possible to make that movie at the time that this one came out?
I think lots of movies have made challenging statements about race and put new ideas into the conversation in history. I mean,
it's easy to say in history, man, but I'm thinking 1970 is just a different cat. Like, I struggle to come up with anything from a year before or after 1970 that makes that kind of case. And I looked. There's something about this year that is spooky in that way.
It's a spooky year.
Well, I mean, like, one thing we talked about a lot with Tora, Tora, Tora was how careful it was with the depiction of the Japanese and how it, you know, like, the American producers hired Japanese directors and, like, didn't just treat them as Foot Clan soldiers.
It's hard to hypothesize because none of us were alive at the time, but...
Wait a minute.
To what extent was MLK's assassination a cooling of these issues in popular culture?
What?
If you're being beamed into the entire country's living room and you're telling a story like this, to what extent are you just prevented from telling the operatic story that would have been necessary at the time?
You mean by the studio or by the network, you mean?
By all the forces, by cultural forces even.
What it seems to me they set out to do was make a movie that provoked white America into rethinking assumptions that they make about black people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they fail utterly in that regard because the movie is racist against black people.
I think that by the time this movie got greenlit, you're already way past the point where it's a question of whether or not white America can handle it. So beyond that, then you have your opportunity. And I don't think any studio executive was going to come down and say, wait a minute, you're making these blacks too heroic. Let's dial it back and make them drunks. You know, like it, I think it was too late by that point. And if Aaron Spelling if he had written a good script, he could have made this like a famous movie. Now, whether or not he was inhibited from doing that by his either prejudice or lack of complete understanding of what people wanted to see, you know, like he may have thought this is what people were ready for, but that would have been his mistake. You know, I think with a cast like this, and we haven't talked about the cast, including Billy Dee Williams, Robert Hooks, Rosie Grier, and Richard Pryor.
It's one of the reasons that I totally disagree with Ben's take that this is a film that's racist against black people. This is a blaxploitation film.
For all those guys to sign on to make this movie, right? Like that's an incredible brain trust of like some of the great actors of our time and comedians and thinkers. I mean, Richard Pryor was already deep into, he wasn't like yet a household name, but he was making the transition that he ended up making to being the comedian of the 20th century. So the guys making this movie had at hand an entire group of people that could have made like a real statement picture. And it just feels like it was a combination of low budget and as Ben is saying, just like a failure of a writing failure, a failure of the imagination, rather than that it was from a studio top down like ratings worry. Because think what a smarter writer and smarter director could have done here. Somebody that was like,
with this wealth of talent, like on the screen, absolutely. Yeah, I grieve for the movie that this could have been, given the actors they brought to bear here.
We should stay on the high ground. Use the trees for cover.
Or you stay on a road.
It's hard for me to think that the actors in this constitute a brain trust also, just because a lot of them are pretty early in their careers when they signed on to this. Like Richard Pryor had credits as early as 1966, but like he was a stand-up, but he was kind of like just starting to get into acting.
But Robert Hooks and Billy Dee Williams were both in their mid-30s, had by this point in time had like, and Moses Gunn was in his almost 50, you know, veteran stage actors.
Yeah, but you know, cast in a thing doesn't necessarily mean you have a lot of say over what happens in it. And I'm wondering if they were like the kind of actor that could, you know, could pass up a role in a TV movie because they didn't totally agree with the statement it makes or whatever.
Well, yeah. I mean, this was exactly the era that you as a black actor could protest a thing and say, I'm not working on this Ofay thing. But like Robert Hooks was a producer. Like he started the Negro Ensemble Company. Like all these guys were not just actors that were signing up for roles. They were the heart and soul of like the black actor cast, you know, like the cast, and I mean cast with an E. Like they were the founders basically of what became kind of the American, you know, the African American temple of acting.
Yeah.
There's another thing, and I, you know, I hesitate to get into it, but like the experience that African Americans have of having their story translated to the screen and to the, you know, to records and, you know, the intermediaries for the black experience in the 20th century were often like American Jews, producers, writers. And, you know, there's a lot of black anti-Semitism in America because that is a very complicated relationship.
Yeah.
That it's, you know, it's very often a Jewish writer writing the black American experience or a Jewish producer. And that's a close relationship between two minority groups in the U.S. And it isn't, you know, when we talk about the black experience being translated for a white audience, you know, almost always isn't being made by some like racist Tennessee director.
It's not Captain Carter making those things. No.
You know, it's always being filtered through that additional level of experience of disenfranchisement that's coming through what is, I think, a very sympathetic lens of Jewish identity. It's just that in that experience, you often find that the Jewish writer maybe extends his own experience or his cultural experience to include the black experience. And then black artists look at that and say, the parallels don't all work. Like your sympathy for us is maybe one-sided or unidirectional rather. Because a Jewish writer can pass, right, in the world in a way that a black actor or writer can't.
Watching this movie, I kind of, like, I was mainly excited by the idea of, like, a modern remake.
Aren't there those? What's the Tarantino movie where it stars Jamie Foxx and Leonardo Tarantino?
Django Unchained.
Django Unchained, right.
Leonardo Tarantino.
And Spike Lee too, like the you could do this exact movie except as a either like a 21st century blaxploitation movie or a total revisionist movie. And that was the other risk of this was it could have veered into total revisionism where the white officer was just a dupe and a cuck and the black guys were all like mega commandos.
Well, it sort of seemed like it may be setting that up, like when the scene where they're throwing knives at the tree, like yeah. I was like, oh, like is it going to make the case that because Billy Dee Williams' character is a born again hard guy from Harlem, he's going to be just as capable in the context of killing a bunch of SS troops that are guarding a dam?
I wondered that too, and after it didn't happen, I kind of was like, maybe that would have been better.
Maybe the revisionism would have been good.
Maybe the revisionism would have at least been more fun.
I'm looking at David Kidd's writing credits. He did Carter's Army, a bunch of other TV movies, and then he pivoted into the Swinging Cheerleaders, Act of Vengeance, and Six Pack Annie. And a few of those writing credits, he took the pseudonym Betty Conklin.
Huh.
Hmm.
A lot of these movies don't look good, is my point.
Yeah. Is Six Pack Annie about a girl that drinks beer?
Six Pack Annie seeks to help her Aunt Tess raise $5,000 for the family diner by trying to find a rich daddy.
She's the pop top princess with the recyclable can.
Whoa.
Oh, boy.
Six Pack Annie. She's dynamite.
like, I think John's point was really interesting about the perspective that a lot of these stories are written by. I'm not sure if that, I mean, it may work in from Aaron Spelling's angle, but I don't think it works necessarily from the David Kidd angle.
It occurs to me that it's a somewhat similar premise to Glory,
right,
which is a, like, Ferris Bueller has an idea of himself as a moral man who is there to prove a point about the capabilities of the black soldiers he's leading. But like, God, Glory is such a high watermark for movies we've watched on this show. And also, I guess, a movie that is very much from a white perspective about the idea of black soldiers, right?
The ending for Glory is so unambiguous. And I think it's one of the reasons that film is great. Like, Broderick's character wasn't a racist in the same way that Carter is in this film, but he's buried with his soldiers at the end. So, like, his transcendence from being superior to the people he leads to being reduced to their equal is never a question in the way that it is in this film. Because at the end of this film, like, I fully believe Carter's going to keep going on continuing to be a racist, and Krunk is going to go on to dig latrines.
I mean, Carter throws that shovel down in disgust at the fact that that Krunk got dissed by those soldiers. So maybe Carter was completely transformed and became a civil rights activist. Maybe he put Krunk in for a Medal of Honor and Krunk became, you know, like a civic leader. He became the mayor of Atlanta.
Man, that the blocking of the convoy coming through and the APC driving by with the General Lee on the hood was pretty dark stuff. Like, not even close to center frame, but the foreshadowing of something bad happening was super present, I thought. Did you get that or no?
I missed that. There was a General Lee on top of one of the trucks.
On top of one of the convoy trucks, yeah. Mm.
I got to say, this was at a time when you could make a TV movie like that and have almost no special effects or really anything even interesting in the movie, and yet still you could find a World War II era fighter plane and hire a guy to come strafe your set.
That was incredible.
Like 200 feet off the deck. I was like, I mean, everything else in this movie, it was like stuff that they found lying around. And then all of a sudden, for the space of one shot,
we've got a BF-109 and we've got a day. Let's go get it.
I couldn't tell whether the message of that, because I didn't rewind it, but it seemed like that airplane had invasion stripes on it. And I wondered whether that was a friendly fire incident, whether that strafing was, because were there any German airplanes in the sky by this point in the war that were just out running sorties, strafing guys on a road?
It's like a very smashed audio track on this film. Like, it's like a mono VHS to DVD to digital. like it's very badly compressed, but it seemed to me that they were layering in the sounds of airplanes and like distant explosions all the way through the soundtrack.
Yeah, they were, but the implication of that was that we were in the very final days of the war and there was shelling all around them. And
right, yeah. And does this movie even care if there were German planes in the air at this point in the war or not? Because it's
right
focused on a totally different thing that it's trying to say about the war.
I feel like that was just between me, Adam, and the people on Facebook that do the planes of friendly fire.
That was a very exciting moment. If that was a real BF-109, even better. Really cool.
Yeah, I felt like the silhouette of it was a P-40 Tomahawk, but maybe I'm wrong.
John, nicely done. It is a P-40 Warhawk, and it's got Luftwaffe markings applied to the wings. So based on silhouette alone,
woo!
You nailed the spot.
All those years of looking at those little silhouette books.
Yeah.
It gave me, with a 1 second shot of that airplane, I was like, something's not right here. The 11 year old in my head was like, wait a minute.
The plane is on the poster. What? Of the movie.
Yeah, the plane's on the poster, but Carter is gone.
Yeah.
You don't want Carter on your movie poster.
No. He's not putting asses in seats.
Oh, so, but wait, it's not the Black Brigade poster. There appears to be a rebranding of this that happened in recent years.
Yeah, I think it got renamed when it was released on DVD to Black Brigade.
What side are you on, man? That fucker's ours!
Was there a moment of pedantry in this film, Ben?
I couldn't find any pedants complaining about anything specific.
I think we just did it with the P-40 and the BF-109 thing. Good job by us.
You guys make sure to add that to IMDb after we're done recording today.
You know what I liked in this film was Susan Oliver's broken English-German accent.
Uh-huh.
I thought she spoke pretty capable German.
She was the character, and I think this was conscious. I think this was intentional. She was the character who portrayed a German that had less racism than the white American.
Right.
So she was just very briefly like hat tipping to the whole issue of black soldiers feeling like they got a better treatment in post-Nazi Germany than they did in their own United States of America.
It feels awful. I mean, once it's revealed the sort of relationship she's made to have with that German officer, I mean, she's fighting her own war too.
I wonder whether this movie intended to be funny. Like whether the kind of, you know, the dice playing and the slapdashness of them, of the brigade at the beginning and the casting of Richard Pryor and Rosie Grier for that matter.
Yeah, like when they come back drunk, it feels like there's an implied laugh track.
Could it be that at some point in the making of this film, they were trying to figure out where to find the tone between almost a MASH level of dark comedy?
Mm.
And then somewhere along the line, there was no comedy. They just never found their rhythm.
That totally explains like the, you know, smash cut to Craps Game as the reveal on the soldiers. Like it almost like the one guy that's writing his diary of the war and it's like fictional is like super fucking tragic. And the fact that he dies from like not having enough bullets because he didn't put them in the spot in his belt where he's supposed to because he had cigarettes there. That's super fucking tragic. But like if the movie thought it was funny, like it makes more sense to me that like putting all that stuff in on that, like that character is like such a painful idea. But maybe the movie thought it was like it was jokes.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could see it all being played for sardonic laughs.
Yeah.
But none of that's there really, because there's just nothing, there's no joy in it.
Yeah.
I don't speak 70s comedy, so maybe it was just lost in translation, like in the same way that I didn't really get MASH.
The thing is, I speak it fluently and it did not, it was not lost in translation.
Are the olds that got mad at us for not liking MASH going to write in again and say, we just didn't get this one?
The olds.
It'll take a long time for their typewritten letters to get to us.
Oh, my God. I'm going to put both of you in quarantine.
That's the briar patch for me, baby.
Each film gets its own custom rating system. And I think early on, this film is telling you what it hopes to be and not what it is. And what I had hoped this film was going to be was Carter challenging all of his soldiers and getting his ass kicked in the process. But one of the earliest scenes of this happening is when Carter challenges Lewis to that knife throwing contest. And Lewis's Billy Dee Williams is just the coolest character in the whole thing. And not only does he have a knife, he's great at throwing it because Carter throws his at a tree, and then Lewis bullseyes his own knife through the back of Carter's knife. It's great. And what I thought from here was that it was going to be every character one-upping Carter in such a way that Carter would finally see the folly of his thinking and see these people around him as capable soldiers. But that's not the film that we get. So on a scale of 1 to 5 throwing knives, we're going to review Black Brigade. I think this is a really challenging film for this project, and it's not just because of its TV moviness. It did provide an interesting challenge in that way, and how easily I was able to ignore the idea of all of its awkward transitions. I really loved the fresh-faced cast that it worked with, and it was really fun to see a youthful Richard Pryor. Like, Richard Pryor is doing stand-up at this moment in his life, but to see a 30-year-old Pryor on screen foreshadowing his own comic film career, I thought was a great experience. This is sort of the ultimate friendly fire movie that we would never see without this podcast.
Yeah.
But this film really hinges on its ending to me, and the idea that only one type of character changes, and it's not the white characters. And if this were a modern film, I would say it was a missed opportunity, but for a film made in 1970, I'm just not even sure that that was possible for it. The Carters and the Crunks of the world get something very different from this film. Like, I do like how in the end, it's Crunk that does become a hero. And I know, like, we started to talk about this earlier before turning away from it, but like, my point with Big Jim giving Crunk his Notre Dame fight song speech was less about the darkness of Ben. I'm trying to paraphrase you, and I don't want to do that incorrectly, but you said something like it's not Crunk's character's responsibility to prove himself to Captain Carter. But I think my point about that scene was that Jim was willing to tell him anything to get him up out of the ditch and keep him alive. And that was a moment between two soldiers, whether or not they're black or not, that I thought was one of the few poignant parts of the thing. That's why Big Jim is my guy, by the way.
Whoa, cart before horse.
But it's such, like, I know the film isn't good, but I think there are some really complicated reasons for why it isn't. I don't think this is a film that the average Friendly Fire subscriber should go see, but I think it's a film that, like, the graduate students and the completionists probably should. Like, I think there will be better blaxploitation war films to come with more complex things to say, and I'm looking forward to seeing those. And I think to see this one as the first of its kind in this project is, I mean, it's a tone setter. I'm kind of at a loss for how to grade it. And given that, I'm going to give it a three knives treatment. Like, I think it's worth studying, and I think all of its flaws are worth seeing for a certain type of person. But I don't think this is the complete story of blaxploitation war films, but it starts a conversation that I think makes it important. So I'm going to go right down the middle with a 3. And I think I could see this, like, receive some really bad scores for all of the ways that it fails, but that's what I'm going to give it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a temptation to just brutalize this movie on the score, but I agree with you that it does serve as an interesting artifact of its time, and I'm really grateful for the conversation that we've been able to have about it. In an interesting way, like, this movie bites off way more than it can chew when it comes to the race relations and issues that it's trying to tackle. But one thing I really appreciate about the film is that the actual mission, the storyline surrounding the actual mission, is like dead simple. It's like, get these guys, go to abandoned farm, use the radio, go to the abandoned winery, go to the bridge, shoot some Germans. Like, there's nothing to it.
Yeah, it's a straight line.
And they never go off that line. Like, the map is so clear. So I think it's worth trying to make this kind of movie. And, like, the most cynical read I have is that the movie is here to make white people feel good about the progress they haven't actually made on racism, but I think it does sneak at least a couple of challenging ideas past the goalie despite that. And I guess I'll give it 2.5 throwing knives. Yeah, not a great movie, but definitely an interesting artifact of its time and a short movie. So it's not even like that big of a commitment if you want to see what this was.
That helps.
It's like less than 90 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, 70 minutes.
Yeah.
I had a really complicated reaction to this film, and the net result of that was that I was on the edge of my seat for the entire film. I was never bored.
Oh, yeah. It's not boring.
No. Partly it was that I was waiting to see what crazy jump cut was going to happen next. But when that plane arrived, when that P-40 flew over, I was like, well, anything goes now. This movie could have a submarine in it. What do they have access to, right? They're filming this movie clearly in the same Southern Californian environment that they made the television show MASH in. It looks nothing like Germany. It's like high altitude California. It just looks like a wildfire about to happen. But at the same time, you know, you can get Billy Dee Williams in it. You know, Billy Dee Williams, who's just sitting over there, like absolutely gnawing the scenery every time the camera's on him, but, you know, given sort of nothing to do. And as a consequence of that, the many layers of it, like the super home movie level of production, but like the sheer star power, charisma of the cast, the fact that the writing was, it was really unclear what point they were trying to make. And at the end, it's like, wait a minute, was I meant to come out of this feeling like all black soldiers were drunk gamblers who were deaf chicken shits? Was that the top line of this script? And so maybe it was just the night that I watched it, but I loved it. I loved it. It was such a wonderful 1970 trash fire that we don't get to see. We don't get to see behind the curtain this much. Adam kept like bringing us back to 1970, like what the hell was going on in 1970? And that is a great question. What the hell was going on in 1970? Kind of everything. Everything was going on in 1970. And this was made in the space of, this was made for $100,000, basically to fill up a Tuesday night primetime slot because ABC was behind in the ratings and they couldn't get Anthony Perkins for this week. You know, so it's like, oh, shit, let's do a thing about, I mean.
Boy, Anthony Perkins as Captain Carter suddenly infuses this thing with some pathos.
Right, the whole thing would switch around. If they had taken one definitive step in any direction of the five directions they could have gone, it would have been, I don't know, a better experience, but also you wouldn't have been able to see the. This is the type of thing where I kept waiting for a microphone to a boom mic to get into. And so I loved it. And it, for me, it's a 4 throwing stars movie. I think everybody should see it. It only takes 70 minutes. You will get something out of it. And it's not a comfortable watch. You don't feel like, you definitely don't feel good at the end. Partly why it's important is that racial politics are still a major, 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 major feature of the civilization we're trying to build right now, right? We're coming back. We're fighting the battles of the last 150 years over again every day in small ways. And all the times along the way that we thought that maybe we were in the clear, we had finally figured it out. We were on the cusp of a post-racial society. And then the house of cards all falls down again. It's just interesting to go back to 1970 and see where we were. Not definitively, but through the eyes of this one totally messed up production, and just try to put ourselves in that moment and just like, huh, Well, they weren't not trying. They, you know, they weren't like not taking a shot at it. And this is what we got. I mean, if this movie came out today, if this movie was watched, you know, by a film studies class, boy, I'd love to be a fly on the wall.
Oh boy, the liberal arts colleges would be burned to the ground if this movie came out today.
And that would be too bad.
Well, yeah. I could see film students running out of the room on fire, running out of the theater themselves personally on fire.
We've got to see more things that make us uncomfortable. And this is an important document in the way that John's described in that respect.
But like not like fires on the plane.
Sure. But like, yeah, I'm using important can mean a lot of things.
Yeah, right. It's 70% unintentionally important. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was amazing.
I like how our groupings for the ratings are getting further and further apart. This is a fun trend. Well, as I said before, my guy is Big Jim. And there are a couple of reasons for that. It's because, one, he's the roller in the craps game during the title scene. And if you've ever been a hot roller in a craps game, you know there's no feeling like it. It's great. It's the greatest. And he's loving it. He's winning cigarettes for everyone. But also, in a less fun way, he's the philosopher of the group. Hmm. When Krunk gets scared and he says he doesn't want to die, he tells him, there ain't nothing to it, just curl up inside yourself. And I thought that was, whether or not it was intentional or accidental, I thought that was really profound of him. And I'm going to think about that a lot after this movie, whenever I'm scared.
Hmm. Just curl up inside yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Ben? Who's your guy?
Well, if you've ever played an open world video game where you're collecting resources and if you're anything like me, you're never sure which ones to get. And, you know, in your Skyrims, in your Fallouts, I'm always, you know, filling my utility bag with lots of stuff, makes my character move super slow. And Private Brightman is definitely my guy because he is susceptible to the same, you know, misjudgment of what is going to be an important resource to amass around yourself. He fills all his ammo pouches with cigarettes because those are the thing that are most valuable in the context that he exists in. And then he's taken outside of that context and he doesn't have bullets when he needs them most. And I feel like I would be the guy that makes that kind of mistake if I ever had to go to a war. So Private Brightman is my guy.
My guy is 100% Susan Oliver.
You just like her because she's in the first episode of Star Trek.
She is. She's the Orion slave girl. painted head to toe in green in the first episode of Star Trek and also appears in the end credits. I'm surprised you guys didn't call her out for that. But
I'm just shocked that you pronounced the name of that show the way you did.
I choose her because she's a classy lady. And I think she's very pretty. And yeah. I always love a fake German accent. I don't care who does it, but I think hers is great. But also, you know, she was a pioneering pilot in real life. She was only the fourth woman to ever fly a transatlantic solo flight in a small plane.
It's amazing.
Single engine plane. So I feel like she's definitely my guy.
I think it's time to pick the next movie. John, do you want to... what color is your dice?
It's a green die. It's a slave die from the planet Orion.
Oh, wow. There it is.
Okay, let's see here. I got to empty out my my dice cup here. Okay, here we go. '79, the year Adam was born.
Okay, we're going to hit our World War II hat trick. This is a 1942 movie from Britain, directed by Noel Coward, called In Which We Serve. Story of a ship. The British destroyer HMS Torin is told in flashbacks by survivors as they cling to a life raft.
Hey, God.
Cool.
Wow. Written, directed by, and starring Noel Coward.
Awesome.
Wow.
Damn. Well, that will be next week, and then of course we will sort the World War II films off of the potential list. But for now, I'm just looking forward to watching In Which We Serve.
Yeah.
So for John Roderick and Adam Pranica, I've been Ben Harrison. To the victor, go the spoiler alerts.
Listen to me. Friendly Fire is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Ben Harrison, Adam Pranica, and John Roderick. The podcast is produced by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is War by Edwin Starr, courtesy of Stone Egg 8 Music, and our logo art is by Nick Dittmer. Looking for some more Friendly Fire to listen to? Last year we covered Raiders of the Lost Ark from 1981, a World War II fantasy film about an archaeologist and his adventures with the supernatural. Friendly Fire is made possible by the support of listeners like you. You can leave us a positive rating and review on your podcatcher of choice. And you can also go to MaximumFun.org/join to pledge your support. If you do, you'll gain access to our monthly pork chop episodes, as well as all of the other Maximum Fun bonus content. You can now follow Friendly Fire on Twitter and on Instagram under the handles FriendlyFireRSS, in addition to the discussion group we have on Facebook. So join in the conversation. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Friendly Fire.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.